You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential. Offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'd like now to welcome Ahmed Abu Artema. He's a Palestinian writer and activist. He's one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, which we'll be talking about in a moment, and Jihad Abu Salim, who is a Palestinian from Gaza. He's a PhD student at New York University, and he's Palestine-Israel Associate at the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. They're both on a speaking tour of the U.S. and have stopped here in Santa Fe. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing us.
Very happy to have you here to tell a story of heartbreak and tragedy that you guys are living and that many Americans are only dimly aware of, if they're aware of it at all. Let's start maybe by talking, Ahmed, about your family history. Your family lost its land in 1948 and was then torn apart again in the early 1980s. Tell us your story.
Yeah, I'm Ahmed. I'm a Palestinian refugee. My family was expelled out by Israeli groups in 1948. Then they came to Rafah, where I born. Actually, 75% of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip are refugees. My family stayed in Rafah, and it was one city until 1982. In that year, Israel split it between Egyptian Rafah and Palestinian Rafah.
And that divide was crazy.
Yeah. That fence, Israel put it across the same house to two parts. A part of the house in Palestine and the other part in Egypt.
So literally lots of houses were divided in half.
Yeah. So thousands of families were split because of this fence. And my family was one of the families who were splitted. I born in Egyptian Rafah, where my mother's family stayed. And my father is in Palestinian Rafah. Then both of them separated. So I stay in Egyptian Rafah the first 2 years in my life.
With your mother?
With my mother. Then my father took me and I stayed in my father's house for 19 years. In all that time, I couldn't go to my mother's home. Despite it's just 150 meters from me.
Could you see her?
Yeah, I can see the house. I can see all the Egyptian Rafah, but it's beyond the fence. So the first time I met my mother after 19 years, and actually it's the first time I be aware of my mother, because the first time I was just 2 years. It was 2005. When the Israeli army pulled out from the Gaza Strip, including the fence between Egyptian Rafah and Palestinian Rafah, then the borders opened just for 3 years. In that 3 years, I visited my mother and I met her for the first time. Then that fence rebuilding and closed again.
What was it like to see your mother after 19 years?
I don't know how can I express it, no words to express it. Yeah, of course, it's very, very tragedy. But I'm not an exceptional story, because there are a lot of Palestinians. Every home has his own tragedy. No house, no family in all Palestine without victims, without a sad story, without a tragedy.
What was it like for you growing up? What was your awareness of being a Palestinian when you were a young person?
When I remember my childhood, I remember the Israeli soldiers, they shot us by tear gas, and they impose banning from getting out from our houses. I remember one of these times when I was a child, they imposed a curfew. They imposed it 2 continuous months. Imagine 2 continuous months you cannot leave your home. In that long time, no one can leave his home. Just every week, they lift this curfew for 1 or 2 hours. The people go to markets and buy materials, then they go back. One of the stories I remembered when I was a child, that time the Israeli soldiers collect all the people of our neighborhood in a square in the neighborhood. Then they destroyed a house in the neighborhood. And I remembered another story. It was in 2004 when I was 20 years. They besieged our neighborhood in the east of Rafah for 10 days. And with coverage from the warplanes, then they killed more than 50 people, and they destroyed the electricity, destroyed the infrastructure in our neighborhood. I remembered in this story, thousands of Palestinians were very angry because our situation was very bad. So they decided to come from the east of our town, Rafah, to break this siege and to give food, to bring food and medicine for us. We were under siege and under blockade. Then the Israeli warplanes struck the unarmed protesters, and killed 15 from them. I remember that story. No car can drive, no ambulance can come in the neighborhood. So the woman who was about to deliver, it was very disaster to them. So their husbands called the radio stations in Gaza Strip and asked help. They cannot arrive to hospitals and no doctors can come to them. Then some of doctors called them and explained to them the steps on the telephone. So there are a lot of sad stories. Actually, we are under occupation. So every time we will live with new tragedies.
So you originated the idea of the Great Return March in Gaza last year. What was the motive? What was the process by which that happened? It involved a Facebook post, among other things.
The motive was, it's not the first time. In 2011, me and my friends invite the refugees to make March of Return in 2011 in May. And actually in that year, tens of thousands of Palestinian refugees, not only in Gaza, but in Lebanon, near the borders with Palestine, in Syria, in Jordan, in West Bank, and in Gaza, they were protesting in that day and tried to return to their homes because they are refugees. On 2018, January, I posted a Facebook status. I mentioned in that Facebook that we are actually dying here in Gaza Strip. We are under siege. We are without human conditions, no electricity, no jobs, no medicine, no life actually. So what if 200,000 of the Palestinians protest peacefully near the fence with Israel and say we want life, we want nothing but life? What will happen? Why are we still dying silently in our homes? Let us knock the door of the prison. And I mentioned in that post, proposed hashtag Great March of Return. Then a lot of activists in Gaza reacted strongly with this idea, and this idea spread widely, and the majority of Palestinians and parties and factions and groups in Gaza adopted this idea. So the motive was We want freedom. We want our humanity. We want our dignity. We want our rights as people. We cannot continue our dying in silence.
And so that led to a march or a protest and then a series of protests. And part of it also was the declaration of Jerusalem as the capital by Donald Trump shortly after he became president.
Yeah, there were a lot of factors that make the Palestinian consensus on this choice. One of them was that they feel that their basic rights, especially the right of return and Jerusalem, in danger because of the policies of Trump when he declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And there is a special symbolism for the Palestinians and for the Arabs in general and Muslims and Christians toward Jerusalem. So they feel Jerusalem, there is a real danger. And the other thing, because Trump's administration, because its position or its policies against UNRWA and against the right of return. The right of return is the most important cause for all Palestinians. No one of the Palestinians can give up this right. So, in that conditions, the idea of the March of Return came, that let us send a strong message for Israel and for the Trump administration and for all the world that we are here, we struggle for our rights, we will never give up our rights.
Talk more about right of return for people who might be listening who don't understand that concept.
The story started in 1948. The Palestinian people were in their land and Israel came. It wasn't Israel yet in that time. The Zionist groups came and they expelled the people and they committed tens of massacres like Deir Yassin and others, and they forced the people, the Palestinian people, forcibly to get out from their lands and their towns. Then the Palestinian refugees in that time, they were 750,000 of the Palestinians were expelled. Some of them went to Gaza Strip, others went to West Bank, others went to Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, and others went to Europe and America. So the Palestinian people became in diaspora because of this Israeli racial cleansing. And in the same year, 1948, on December 11, the United Nations General Assembly published a resolution, 194. This resolution said that the Palestinian refugees should return to their homes and give them compensations for the losses. Until now, Israel doesn't implement this UN resolution. And until now, the Palestinian people keep this right alive in their hearts. They never forget it. So the generation, the first Palestinian generation, when a lot of them were dying, they gave their keys, the keys of their homes and houses, to their sons, and the papers of property for their homes and their farms. They gave them for their sons, and then the sons gave them for their grandchildren. So the Palestinians, until now, they are struggling for their normal right to return to their homes. Before I came here to the United States, I went to Jordan, and I visited the Palestinian refugees camps there. Until now, they paint on the walls, "We will return to our homes," and bend the key as a symbol of the homes they were expelled from there. And they called the names of markets there by the names of the villages, the Palestinian villages and towns. So the Palestinians are still struggling for the right of return. And this right is not just theoretical question. First, they must return because it's their right, regardless of any other thing. But in addition to this, they can return to their homes because 85% of the lands of refugees is still empty until now, after 70 years, or with low density. So Israel now say welcome for any Jewish man decided to return to Israel. And we haven't a problem with the Jewish people. Our problem with occupation and with expulsion. So, by the same way, why don't Israel open its doors for the refugees in Gaza and in West Bank and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and say to them, welcome. Welcome to your homes and to your properties. There is a new justification for this Israeli disagreement. This justification that their Palestinian refugees are not Jews. Just this is the reason. So Israeli practice, unfortunately, practice racial discrimination and practice apartheid against Palestinians. And so we haven't other choices but to still in this struggle for freedom and to return to our homes.
It surprises me to hear that so much of the land that you were expelled from, that your people were expelled from, is still empty, because we hear so much about the settlements that have taken over that land.
Yeah. What I told you, it's scientific studies that determine that the Israelis are concentrating in specific cities. But the towns that the Palestinian refugees were expelled from, the majority of it are still empty until now, or Israel built their parks and like this.
I would like also to add that most of the settlements you referred to are being built in the territory that is supposed to be the territory for the future Palestinian state. So Israel has been building settlements in the West Bank, which is occupied, considered an occupied territory under international law, and according to international law, Israel does not have the right to move its civilian population to that occupied territory. So it's not only that Israel expelled Palestinians from their original towns and villages and cities that it conquered in 1948, but also it's building settlements and expanding beyond the boundaries of, according to the current international understanding, supposed to be the boundaries of the state of Israel, the 67 lines.
And so basically what that does is make a two-state solution virtually impossible.
Definitely. And this is the platform of the Likud party, the ruling party in Israel today. No two states in the charter of the Likud. There is no mention of any Palestinian connection to the land. The West Bank is referred to as Judea and Samaria. And in almost all of the maps that are circulated in Israel, formally and informally, Palestinian land also is incorporated as part of the reality. That's what Israeli journalist Gideon Levy described as the one-state situation, whereas you have one group, one ethnic group, has more citizenship rights and more access to privileges and rights, and another group that suffers from discrimination.
I have to say, every time I read about it or watch documentaries, it does, in a lot of ways, remind me of the conquest of this continent that we're on right now, where the indigenous people had their land, were kicked off, treaties were made, the treaties weren't abided by, and now people are stuck in basically reservation land or assimilated into cities.
Yes, what's happening in Palestine is a classic story of settler colonialism. We have been suffering from an erasure. And erasure means, in our context, like in the context of many groups and populations and people who lost their lands and fell victim to such settler expansion, we Palestinians have been in this land for centuries. We established a vibrant culture and society. We built the land. There are many, many monuments that stand to witness to our contribution and how we preserved the land and took care of it throughout the centuries. That didn't really spare us the effects of the European settler colonial mentality that defined the Zionist political Zionism and the Zionist project as it was establishing settlements in Palestine, leading to the establishment of the State of Israel. When the early Zionist settlers arrived to Palestine and started building their settlements, they referred to Palestine as a land without a people, although they saw Palestinians all over the place around them. And this speaks to how they only want to have one narrative. They want to monopolize the story of the land. They want to project one narrative on it, although it's been a land that hosted many religions, many faiths, many cultures, a land where people have been constantly moving in and out of it, a land that that cannot be monopolized. The story, the Palestinian story, is a story of diversity, is a story of richness, is a story of many faiths and many religions and many cultures coming together. Palestine has been historically a melting pot for many people who lived on that land and prospered and went and came and so on. So it's a story similar to what happened here, indeed. It's a story of settler colonialism. It's a story of denial of an entire people connection to the land in which they lived for centuries.
One of the things going on in the Palestinian areas is that there is insufficient employment for a lot of people, especially young men. And as we know from the history of pretty much the whole world ever, when you've got a bunch of young, angry, disenfranchised men, there is violence. Now, you have committed yourself, Ahmed, to nonviolence. Talk about the dynamic of that kind of anger, how it's channeled, violence, nonviolence that you see in your community.
Yeah, let us agree that the first problem is the occupation, not the react against this occupation. So, yeah, I have my perspective and my ideas toward nonviolent, and I support it, I believe in it, but I cannot condemn the victims. I cannot blame the victims. So I will speak about Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip is a small part of Palestine, just 1% of Palestine. Gaza Strip, in that place, there are 2.2 million Palestinians lived in one of the most densely populated territories in the world. 2.2 million Palestinians live there, and 75% of them are refugees, Palestinian refugees. That means this is not Gaza Strip, not their original place. Their original place behind the fence where Israel banned them to return to their homes and their lands. In that narrow place, the crossings are closed. Israel claimed that they pulled out from Gaza in 2005, but until now, they banned anyone to leave Gaza by sea. They besieged Gaza from the west by navy, and they besieged Gaza from the east and the north by the fence, and anyone close to that fence, they shot him and killed him. And they banned Palestinians from rebuilding the airport to connect them with the outside world after Israel destroyed it completely in 2001, just 3 years after it was built.
So you have a destroyed airport that you're not allowed to rebuild.
Yeah. And no one of the Palestinians can leave Gaza, few people. So imagine in that place, this place, according to the United Nations reports, is unlivable. There is no electricity. The electricity cut off 16 continuous hours, then come just for 4 hours, and no water, no clean water, no medical services. Hundreds of patients were dying in that last 12 years because of Israel prevent Palestinians from building new hospitals and supply them with medical services and the urgent needs. And the unemployment is very high in Gaza. So the people in general inside Gaza cannot see any future, cannot see any hope, cannot get a job, get a house, a small house, cannot get married. So how can you imagine this person's under siege, under occupation, under pressure to make with the occupation. I believe in non-violence because I think it can inspire the people across the world. It can show them that our issue is very just and we struggle for justice, we struggle for humanity. But I cannot blame the victim when he was angry with this reality. Israel doesn't kill us just in the March of Return. In the March of Return, Israel killed more than 200 unarmed Palestinians and injured thousands. A lot of them lost their limbs. But this wasn't the first time Israel killed us. Israel actually killed us when they expelled us out from our lands. Then they expelled us by occupation. Then they killed us by siege. So this is the reality. Yeah, there is a lot of challenge to convince the youth under siege, under pressure, he live without hope, to convince him to use non-violence against the Israeli occupation. But despite this, the Palestinians used this method, used the method of non-violent struggle in the March of Return. In the first day in the March of Return, more than 100,000 of the Palestinians, all of them collected, elderly women, men, youth people, from all the spectrum, they collected peacefully and they said that we are peaceful. We are peaceful people. We want our rights. We want life. But Israel, because Israel feel impunity, they used the lethal violence against these unarmed people.
You have been living with this all your life. You have children. How do you explain to your children the world that they're growing up in?
Yeah. I loved my children. I love my children. And I hope that their life will be better. And I try to protect them from this reality. But it's very difficult because the root of the problem is the occupation. This occupation should be ended. The Palestinians must get their freedom. Is it too much to demand our freedom? Is it too much to demand our humanity? So, as example, my child Abdurrahman, he's 4 years old. When he heard the voice of the planes, he's fear. And he ran toward me. And I embrace him and I try to protect him. I said to him, these sounds are far in the sea. They will not arrive here. He said, no, they will strike us. I said to him, no, they will not strike. I know I don't tell him the fact because actually there are a lot of children were killed in the same age of my child age or their fathers were killed because of these planes. But if I cannot change the reality, at minimum I try to protect my children. I try to let them feel safe. Even if this feeling was temporary. So we said we cannot adapt with this reality. This reality should be ended. I cannot imagine how in the 21st century there are regimes still based on occupation and settlement and fences and discrimination against peoples.
Jihad, you are, as we mentioned, a PhD student at New York University. What are you studying and what are your hopes for your work as a scholar to help your people?
I study the pre-1948 intellectual history of Palestinian and Arab writings on Zionism and the Zionist project in Palestine, and how Palestinians and Arabs also wrote about the plight of the Jewish people in Europe then. So I'm trying to map out the different ways Arabs and Palestinians looked at what was happening to the Jewish people in Europe in light of the Holocaust and the, you know, like really horrible crimes that were committed against them. And at the same time, I'm trying to figure out how did they manage to have a nuanced analysis of what was going on in Palestine as they were resisting Zionist settler colonialism. So this is a big question, as you can see, but I'm trying to basically map out the language that Palestinians had and Arabs in general to address these issues, to address what was going on in Europe, but also what was happening in Palestine. I think the importance of my work lies in that, in the fact that today, in light of, you know, resurgence of anti-Semitism in the West, and this conversation about anti-Semitism and how do we criticize Israel without falling into using anti-Semitic tropes and whatnot, you know, as we saw with what happened to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and other many other examples of equating criticism to Israel and Zionism with anti-Semitism. I think my work comes in to contribute to showing that Palestinians historically have had the proper language to criticize the Zionist project and its manifestations on the ground, but at the same time be aware of what was going on, the crimes that were committed against the Jewish people, and how they expressed sympathy and how they talked about these things. So I think this is going to be a contribution to the discourse, a contribution to the history. And unfortunately, you know, most of the works I'm researching from before 48 were lost in 1948. So a lot of Palestinians, when they lost their houses, their books and their notes and their work, their research was also lost. And many of these books are still held in the basement of the Israel National Library.
And you can't access them.
I can't access them. Yeah. So what I'm doing, I'm reaching out to Palestinian citizens of Israel, asking them to, you know, dig for some sources for me. And I'm also looking at stuff that, you know, that are in various libraries here in the U.S. and universities and so on. So, you know, being here in the U.S., I left Gaza 5 years ago. I'm unable to go back because I'm married here in the U.S. My wife is Palestinian-American. My family is in Gaza. And because I'm still in my PhD program, I can't risk going back, because if I go back to Gaza, I might get stuck. And because my wife is Palestinian-American, it's going to be hard for her to visit Gaza as well. I haven't seen my family since I left. So while doing this work, I am personally affected by the blockade. Sometimes young Palestinians like me think that by leaving Gaza, the blockade will end for them, but it's not true. The blockade follows us, even when we are in a place like the U.S., because we still feel every holiday, every vacation, we see our friends going back to visit their families, spend some time with them, except for us. We either stay here or go there. Visiting Gaza is like traveling to another planet for me at this point. I got married almost a year ago, and my family attended my wedding on FaceTime. It was really hard to apply for them for visas to come here. So it's you know, it's a painful experience. Every day is a reminder of how much privileges we don't have, and that we are always reminded of our reality as Palestinians, that we're not recognized fully as people who have full rights and better access to the world.
Right. Ahmed, how is it that you were able to travel?
Yeah, it's a long story. I tried to travel since 6 years, since 2013. Every time I went to border or tried to travel, they said to me, you should be patient or student or have another passport to be able to travel. I get angry and I said to them, but I'm a human. It's my human right to travel, to see the world, to meet people from other countries, from other cultures. This is the justification. Finally, I received an invitation from United Nations Human Rights Committee, which published its report just before 2 weeks. They invited me to meet with them in Amman, the capital of Jordan. So this invitation is my departure from Gaza. Then after I arrived there, I received an invitation from American Friend Service Committee to share in a national speaking tour here in the United States. So I got my visa from the American Embassy in Jordan, and I came here directly to United States.
So the two of you have been on this speaking tour. What's it been like? How have you been received in the cities where you've been?
It's been a really wonderful experience. We started in Harvard. We spoke, our first event was at Harvard. then we had our Chicago event. Then we went to Madison, Wisconsin, the Bay Area, spoke at San Diego, and we're speaking here in Santa Fe. It's been a really wonderful experience. We've been trying to convey the message of our people that they want their rights and freedom, and we have been really welcomed and embraced by really great and wonderful communities here across the U.S. The tour, when we at AFSC planned it, we wanted the tour not to be a two-way learning experience, a learning experience for us to hear from Ahmed, to hear his stories, and to listen to his vision and to how he sees the future. But also we wanted Ahmed to be exposed to other struggles in the U.S., other movements that are working for justice, not only on Palestine, but on other issues. So we visited the city of Detroit, where Ahmed got to meet with African Americans and hear their stories about deindustrialization, gentrification, and how they're struggling for a better future there. We went to the U.S.-Mexican border, where we participated in a service on this just Sunday, in a place called Friendship Park, where people pray on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border and pray for a better world and pray for these walls, not only the physical walls, but also the psychological walls that exist in the minds of people who prefer to live beyond them. We also met with, we spoke at different synagogues, and that was very informative for us and for Ahmed and for the our Jewish friends and colleagues who took the time and energy and came and participated in these discussions and asked the hard questions. You know, we talked about the right of return, we talked about what will that mean for both Israelis and Palestinians, how do we see the future in light of what's going on. We also introduced Ahmed to the Palestinian American community. As you may know, Chicago is home for the largest Palestinian American community in the U.S. You know, more than 200,000 Palestinians live there. So he got the chance to talk to Palestinians here in the U.S. and connect with them. The idea of the tour is to break the siege of Gaza, break the blockade through one person. But because of Ahmed's role in Gaza as a writer, as an intellectual, as a contributor to the public discourse, we feel that by bringing him to these experiences and by inviting him to speak here, we're building a bigger connection that will remain beyond the tour. We think that building these connections will help bring Gaza into the conversation here, but also situate Gaza and the struggle for liberation and freedom in Palestine within the larger framework of struggles for justice in the U.S. and beyond.
Very interesting. So let's talk about the big question, which is, what is the way forward? What is the vision? I mean, as long as I've been doing journalism, the same narrative has been going on over and over again that springs from the occupation and the violence and the settlements, all of which goes back to 1948, 1967, 1982. So what next? I mean, we have Donald Trump, which is not good for Palestinian people, a very right-wing Israeli government. What's the vision? What's the hope? How can it come to be a reality?
Yeah. The vision simply that justice must be achieved. We as Palestinians, we don't demand complex things. We demand simple things. We want our humanity. We want equality like other people. We want our freedom. So the occupation, we cannot adapt with the occupation. We cannot adapt with the reality of expulsion. So we speak with all the people who believe in humanity and believe in justice and believe in dignity. We and you both in one struggle. Let us strengthen ourselves. Let us struggle together for humanity, struggle together for a new reality. This reality based on humanity. I am a human, you are a human, so we have the equal rights. I cannot see in the future the reality of fences, the reality of walls, the reality of discrimination between people. We are similar. All the people are similar. So why they built fences and walls between them, separate between them? Let us push toward how can we create a new world, a world better, which all the people have the same rights, have the same rights regardless of their religion, their color, their nationality, their race, just because they are humans. In Palestine, we want our freedom, we want equality, we want justice, we want the implementation of the international justice.
What does that look like politically?
Well, this is a very interesting moment for all the sides. We are witnessing an Israeli slide towards the right. The Israeli elections now are between a general who, Benny Gantz, who bragged about the number of Palestinians he killed in the most recent operation against Gaza, and a Prime Minister Netanyahu who's aligning himself with the Kahanists, and he invited them to join his coalition. This is a group that is considered terrorist in the U.S. Trump is in power, and this is a moment where Benjamin Netanyahu sees an opportunity and an opening, because, you know, in light of the rise of the right wing globally, so he sees that the classic liberal order, the post-World War II order, with all of its flaws, which it never helped us as Palestinians, but still, Israel had to pay attention to it. Netanyahu sees that this order is on the decline with the rise of these isolationist, xenophobic, right-wing governments all over the world. We see that he welcomes Bolsonaro, he welcomes Modi, he's the most excited politician in the world about Donald Trump. So he sees an opening in that, and he sees an opportunity to further his short-term political career, and also to further Israeli settlement and expansion in Palestinian land, and to abort Palestinian rights. So this is the bad news. The good news is that politically in the U.S. we are seeing a shift in the discourse on Palestine. We see that many young people, including young Jewish members of the American Jewish communities, are no longer interested in being progressive on everything except for Palestine. We see a growing awareness amongst faith communities in the U.S., amongst even politicians. Just, you know, a year ago or a little bit more, Congresswoman Betty McCollum of Minnesota introduced the first proactive bill in support of Palestinian human rights in U.S. political history, H.R. 4391, which will be reintroduced soon, hopefully. And this bill advocates against Israeli policies of detaining and torturing Palestinian children. We see a shift in the discourse. So I think we can't separate what's happening in Palestine from what's going on a global stage. The more progressive victories we achieve here in the U.S. and beyond, and the more we challenge right-wing, xenophobic, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic governments, we will see a concrete change in the way the situation unfolds in Palestine. Benjamin Netanyahu thinks that he can get away with all the things he does, and he wants a world where he can get away with it. That's why the challenge ahead of us as Palestinians, as African Americans, as progressive Americans, as indigenous people in the U.S., as progressive worldwide, is not to allow this to happen. Because it's not only about Palestinians, it's about humanity, like Ahmed said, it's about all of us. The world in which Netanyahu feels comfortable doing his policies and implementing his discriminatory policies is a world that is going to be bad for all.
There was a little documentary with you on Al Jazeera English, which I was watching, and sort of the operative visual metaphor was birds. And I think you talk to your children about being free in the way that birds are free.
Yeah, I believe in freedom because I think it's the most essential issue for the humanity. I experience personally, me and all my people, we experience what does it look like when you be deprived from your freedom. So I have sensitivity toward the value of freedom. I want freedom for me, for my people, for all peoples, and for animals and for birds. So I think freedom equals life. God created us free. So who has the right to deprive us from this freedom? when the people are free, so they can feel love, so they can feel sympathy, they can be positive, they can be creative. All the goodness things, all the goodness values we can achieve by freedom, by respect the humanity of the people.
Ahmed Abu Artema and Jehad Abu Salim, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The Santa Fe New Mexican is hiring. Immediate spots are open in the company's production department, and eagle-eyed listeners with a keen sense of style, wit, and diligence can learn more about copy editing positions at Pasatiempo. Visit sfnm.co/TNM_careers for more information. We'll also include the link on today's podcast at radiocafe.org. The Santa Fe New Mexican is an equal opportunity employer. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.